Bill, welcome to Bob Burney Live.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Chris.
Bill, thanks so much for joining us today, and I want to thank you for the American Minute. Really, there's so many things every day that you put out in the email that are little views of American history. It's just a little paragraph or two, but it's so rich in the history. And for those who want to get logged on to the American Minute, how do they do that?
Oh, they can just go to AmericanMinute.com. AmericanMinute.com, and again, it's a free daily email of something that happened on history on that day, and from the Civil War to the Revolutionary War to up to the present, just a great background on where our country came from.
Absolutely, and my wife and I, we homeschool, and I teach the history and geography, and of course, you've helped me out quite a bit. Well, Bill, hang on right there. We're going to come right back. We're going to a break. With us on the phone is Bill Fetter from the American Minute, and we'll be right back after these messages. Don't go away.
Walk in the Word, weekday mornings at 7:30 with James McDonald on the Word, 880 WRFD.
Listen, think, discern. This is Bob Burney Live.
Welcome back, and filling in for Bob this afternoon, I'm Chris Long. I'm the president of the Ohio Christian Alliance, and with me on the phone is Bill Fetter. We're going to take a few minutes to reflect upon the life of Martin Luther King Jr., who his birthday was today, and the nation is taking a day off in observance of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Bill, welcome back to Bob Burney Live.
It's great to be with you, Chris.
Bob, I'm sorry, Bill, let's first go to the American Minute today, because I think that's an important point, if you would start us there.
Well, Martin Luther King was a minister. A lot of times we forget that. He was a Baptist minister. Matter of fact, his dad was a Baptist minister, and his grandfather was a Baptist minister. He pastored the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, and the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. He formed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And the reason I bring all that up is this is what motivated him, the Judeo-Christian belief system. And you wouldn't know that today. You would think maybe he was a Muslim or something, the way that the news portrays him or groups him with other people that want to get across an agenda. But on April 16th of 1963, King wrote, "As the Apostle Paul carried the gospel of Jesus Christ, so I am compelled to carry the gospel. I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. I stand in the middle of two opposing forces. One is the force of complacency, and the other is the force of bitterness and hatred, and comes perilously close to advocating violence. It is expressed in the various black nationalist groups, the largest being Elijah Muhammad's Muslim movement." He said, "Nourished by frustration over racial discrimination, this movement is made up of people who have lost faith in America." He goes on to say that they consider the white man the incorrigible devil. Martin Luther goes on to say, "I have tried to stand between these two forces, for there is a more excellent way of love." He says, "One day the South will know that when these disinherited children of God sat down at the lunch counters, they were standing up for what is best in the American dream and the most sacred values in our Judeo-Christian culture." And I thought it was interesting that here he by name warns the country of the black Muslim movement. And he's very critical of it, saying these people have lost faith in America and they advocate violence. And all throughout Martin Luther's writings, you'll see where he is against violence over and over again. Another place he says these black nationalist ideologies, a development that would inevitably lead to a frightening racial nightmare. Here he says we cannot... This is August 28th, 1963. Says, "We must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. New militancy, which has engulfed the Negro community, must not lead us to distrust all white people." And the reason I bring that out is because in prisons today, the Muslim movement is basically proselytizing. and trying to say that the Islam is the black man's religion and that Christianity is the white man's religion, and nothing could be further from the truth. That Jesus was Semitic, he was a Jew, and he wasn't white, Caucasian, from the Caucasus Mountain areas, you know, of Europe. And matter of fact, Islam believed in enslaving the blacks. You read the Quran, Muhammad, who was an Arab, was very, very critical of blacks, calling them all kinds of names that I won't even say on the air. And so it's really been a twist to try to say that this is a black religion. But here's a quote. When Martin Luther King won the Nobel Prize in 1964, he said, "Nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time. The need for man to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to oppression and violence." And, you know, again, you compress this to the jihad warriors, that's their whole method, is aggression and violence. Martin Luther King says, "Man must evolve, for all human conflict, a method that rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love." And in his book, Trumpet of Conscience, Martin Luther King Jr. explains, "The limitation of riots is that they cannot win, and their participants know it. Hence, rioting is not a revolutionary, but a reactionary act, and it invites defeat. It involves an emotional catharsis, but it must be followed by a sense of futility." Now, emotional catharsis is like, you know, you blow up and you yell and you get all angry, and then you feel like, gee, I've let it out. But so you have that feeling of relief, so to speak. But he says, then you're left with this feeling of futility, like, you know, we really didn't do anything except make, you know, fools of ourselves and cause trouble. But I think that when we reflect upon Martin Luther King's faith, for example, in his speech in April 16th of 1963, Martin Luther King ends by saying, "One day the South will know that when these children sat down at the lunch counters, they stood up for what was best in our Judeo-Christian heritage, thereby bringing our nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formation of the Constitution." And so the wells of democracy were this Judeo-Christian heritage. And, you know, just a quick example is...
You know, Bill, this is what I think gets lost in the observance of Martin Luther King Jr., is that indeed he was a Christian minister. He was advocating the Judean Christian values. You know, he was a go-between because of the radical Muslims through, you know, the Muslim black Muslim tide at the time that was threatening violence to American cities. We're going to talk with Bill Fetter. We're going to go to a break right now. Bill, hang on the line with us. Bill Fetter from the American Minute with us, and we're talking about Martin Luther King Jr. in observance of his birthday. We'll be right back after these messages. Don't go away.
877-BOB-LIVE. Call Bob now at 1-877-BOB-LIVE. This is Bob Burney Live.
We're back with Bill Fetter from the American Minute, and we're talking about Martin Luther King Jr. on this observance of his birthday and the federal holiday. One of the great movies that's coming up next month is called Amazing Grace, the life of William Wilberforce, the great abolitionist in the British Empire and, of course, in the British Parliament. Bill, what's your thoughts about this movie that's coming out?
Well, Chris, I am very excited about this movie. I've seen a trailer of it, and it almost brought me to tears. William Wilberforce lived in England in the early 1800s, and he came out against slavery. And when he first introduced the bill in Parliament to get rid of slavery, he was laughed down. Everybody just thought it was a big joke because England's economy rested on slavery, the free labor and then the trading of slaves, and it was a big commercial endeavor.
Well, in fact, the movie brings it out, and I saw that trailer as well. What the quest that he was about in his lifetime of seeing the end of slavery in his nation, That's no small task. I mean, it was a large part of their economy was based upon the slave trade, was it not?
Definitely. And it so he was taking on the big financial interests, sort of like in Missouri, how we had to take on the big financial interests in this cloning bill, that there was one guy, Jim Stowers, who's got a $100 million research facility for cloning. He put $30 million into pushing the cloning. So when you have big business and big money behind something that's unethical, like in England, they had the big business behind the slave trade. And so they were fighting him, but every year William Wilberforce would bring up the issue of getting rid of slavery year after year. And then finally he'd get one other parliamentarian to join him, and then another, and then another, and then another, until finally they voted to end the slave trade. But the next step was, what do you do with the slaves that are already enslaved, that are here? And so he had to pick up the gauntlet again and fight to free the existing slaves. And finally, on his deathbed, they came in and told him that it had passed, that slavery was outlawed in the entire British kingdom.
You know, Bill, it's amazing to me that we have not seen a major movie about this story, because it is such a huge part of history and very moving. In fact, for Christians, they'll be glad to know that the author of Amazing Grace, John Newton, was a contemporary and a very close friend of William Wilberforce, and a very touching part in the movie when they're conversing about what Wilberforce is attempting to do in Parliament.
And John Newton was older than William Wilberforce, and he had been a young man. His dad was in the British Navy. His dad had gotten him to, when his mom died, the dad got him a position, you know, as a young boy in one of the British vessels. Well, at one of the stopping times there in England, he went on a visit to a girl, a girlfriend, and he fell in love. And he stayed longer than he should have, as most guys are tempted to do. And anyway, he when he finally left and ran back, the boat had left. And so here he is at the port, and he gets pressed into a gang. Now, the way it worked is, if you were a young, you know, a healthy man, and you were hanging around a port, sometimes some rogue ships would stop, and a gang of guys would go out. They call them press gangs, and they would catch some young kid on the street and grab him and tie him up and just drag him back to the boat and then take off. And here he is, hundreds of miles away from home. He can't jump over the boat and swim back. He's stuck, and so he's forced to be a sailor on that ship. And so that's what happened to John Newton. He was forced to be a sailor, and he was so disrespectful that he got traded to a slave ship. And then he was so disrespectful there that the slave captain sold him as a slave to one of the slave trading plantations there on the African coast. What it was is, the different African tribes would attack each other and kill each other, and after a while they found out that they could sell their captives to the Muslims rather than kill them and make some money off it. And so there were groups of blacks that would capture other tribes and turn them in, and then they would turn around and sell them to the British. Now, John Newton was held captive on one of these plantations in Africa. He writes about it in his book, because there was a, you know, sort of like the queen gal who was the wife of the slave trader, and she sort of treated the little slave plantation as her kingdom, and he was treated like trash. But finally, one of the ships came to slave trade, and he was able to get off onto it. But he was so bad. There was no morals about having sex with the slave women on the ships, and if they were being chased by some boat that was trying to stop the slave trade, they would simply throw the slaves overboard. I mean, our Coast Guard in America started to stop the importation of slaves. And so some of these slave ships would not want to get caught, and so they just throw all the slaves overboard. Just horrible, horrible treatment of human life. Matter of fact, in the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson gets rid of slavery. The very first original draft of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson listed 19 reasons why we were rebelling against King George, and the 19th one was the worst. He said, "The king has enslaved a people who has never offended him in a distant continent and transported them against their will, many of them dying in the transportation thither, and he's stopped every effort of the colonies to end this trade in human commerce.
Right. And from our beginning, the abolitionists were part of the Continental Congress. A lot of the members of the Continental Congress and our founding fathers were abolitionists, but unfortunately that struggle continued nearly for another 100 years until it was brought to a resolution. With me on the phone is Bill Fetter. We're going to be right back after these messages. Don't go away. You're listening to Bob Burney Live.
This is Bob Burney Live. This is Bob Burney Live. Bob Burney Live. Listen, think, discern. This is Bob Burney Live.
We're back with Bill Fetter from the American Minute, and we've been taking some time to observe the life of Martin Luther King Jr. and, of course, the message that he brought as a Christian minister to the civil rights movement. And, Bill, you brought up something earlier, and we just have a few minutes before the top of the hour, but you brought up about the quote from today's American Minute that the Martin Luther King really was talking about being a go-between, a person who really interjected himself between those who really wanted more of a violent response in the civil rights movement.
Yeah, in his address there in Birmingham, Alabama, on 1963, he says, "I have the honor of serving as president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, an organization operating in every southern state." And he goes, and one of these organizations is the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights. And he says, just as the Apostle Paul left his village in Tarsus and carried the gospel of Jesus. But these were Christian organizations. And he caps it all off with a statement he made in 1955, just when he was basically beginning, in December 31st. He says, "If you will protest courageously, yet with dignity and Christian love, when the history books are written in future generations, the historians will have to pause and say, there lived a great people, a black people who injected new meaning into the dignity and veins of civilization." And I think that gets overlooked nowadays because of the political correctness and this effort of the media to downplay anything that's Christian. And but, you know, our country, for those that aren't familiar with history, we...
Well, Bill, I'm going to have to cut it right there, but what's the name of your new book that's being released?
The new one is called The Original 13.
The Original 13. And how to contact Bill is at AmericanMinute.org. Bill, thanks for being my guest today.
Hey, great to be with you.
God bless you, friend. We'll be right back.